and a research agenda. This will be our first presentation. And then we have Seema Joshi from the University of Delhi in India. Can IT and ITS be an engine of growth and empirical analysis? Unfortunately, Amer Al-Rubi is not here, could not make it. So please cross off rethinking globalization. We won't be having that. But we'll have the first, the two ICT presentations, after which we will take some questions and answers. And then we are inserting from session three yesterday, Nolana E. Lynch. That should have happened at session three yesterday, and she has only just been able to make it here. So we will be having her presentation on gendered applications of the carbon footprint, the use of carbon management tools to highlight the effect of gender on sustainable lifestyles. So while it's not related to our session five topic, we will allow that presentation afterwards. Okay, so we will actually be having three presentations this morning. I'd like to welcome the panelists. And this session is of particular interest to me because ICT in learning is the lifeblood of what we at UWI Open Campus actually do. So I'm actually looking forward to this presentation. I'll turn you over to Marcia, who will be doing the first one. Welcome, Marcia.
Hello, good morning, colleagues. Before I start, I just wanted to say to the St. Lucians how touched I was by that video, and it brought it home a lot more than just looking at some banana plants and some trees that had been blown down around the hotel. I really hope that you can find your footing and get back up and in business quickly. Okay, it's doing it now.
You got it?
Yes, okay. Thanks. Okay, the name of my paper is A Holistic Approach to Organizational Learning in Manufacturing. It's a conceptual model that has been proposed by looking at literature in the field, and our aim is to test that model in order to see correlations between several factors that we think will influence organizational learning. Over the past day and a half, we've heard a lot about what sustainability is and why we need to look at sustainable development in our countries. A lot of talk has come up about encouraging partnership with private sector, but we have heard a lot about policy and we haven't heard too much about how we get the private sector to partner with us. The paper that I'm talking about today is focusing on the private sector. It's focusing on how do we help the private sector to actually implement learning systems so that it can innovate, so that it can become entrepreneurial, so that it can not only use transformative or large innovative methods, but use incremental innovation methods as well, because you have to continually learn if you are to become competitive. So we are talking about embedding in the culture of an organization a focus on learning and a focus on improving. And that is through learning by people, changing systems and processes, and changing policies. And it means that you work with the leaders and you go all the way down to the individuals and the systems that enable them to work together and to improve. All organizations face challenges that will be about the need to learn effectively. Without the ability to learn, those organizations are going to suffer ineffectiveness, inefficiency. They're going to find that their people are not staying. And when people leave, you lose your competitive edge. You lose the experience that is in-house. And therefore, somebody else has to be trained to do it. If the person goes with the information, then you have to create it anew. And what you find is you can never recreate what you lost. So we have to find a way to incorporate what people call knowledge management. How do I capture the knowledge? How do I store it? And how do I disseminate it? And then how do I build that knowledge management system into an organizational learning model so that I not only have it available, but I make sure that people use it, they know how to find the information, they want to use it, and then they adapt that knowledge to make it contextual or suitable to the context. When Professor Lewis spoke this morning, he mentioned Singapore. And he talked about how Singapore started off by partnering with the US in the Vietnam War. And they started by making uniforms. They knew that that was not a sustainable activity. It was a short-term activity, and the environment would change. And as the environment changed, they would have to change how they would get the economy supported, right? Basically, what we're saying is that by continually learning and by setting up these organizational learning systems, we are going to enable companies to look at the external environment and adapt. And the only way that we can find out what model works for our context is not to copy some global model that exists, but to take the various models that are available in piecemeal fashion from many westernized countries and merge them together, and then to test which parts of that model really apply to us and which parts don't. So the paper is about proposing such a model based on the literature. This is just a diagram that I got from one of the contributors to the literature. It's a pair of people called Pemberton and Stonehouse, and it was dated in 2000. They basically said knowledge management and organizational learning are related theories, but they must be merged in order for us to get the most value. Because we have to continually update our knowledge, and then we have to put it in context and make sure that people learn based on the knowledge we have. You can't have a static system. The model is intended to help us to generate knowledge, to build human capacity and competitiveness, to enable innovation, to enable continual learning, to engage the private sector, because all of my research will be done through the private sector, in the first case in manufacturing, which is what this paper was written on, and to stimulate partnering with various stakeholders, especially the private sector. The research started by looking at these several models, and we are talking about maybe 20, 30 models that were gleaned from all around the world. The weakness is that we have found that the models, the empirical research as well as the theoretical models, have come from westernized economies. So it has come from the US and the UK and all of these big industrialized countries, and that's why it will not be able to fit immediately into our context. There have been a few countries, such as Taiwan and Malaysia, that have tested organizational learning models, but they haven't tested a holistic organizational model. Some of the things that we've found have been lacking are consideration of such issues as culture, and issues such as going beyond the IT aspect of knowledge management to the soft issues that surround knowledge management and learning. So we want to propose a holistic model that talks about the processes of learning, the methods by which people learn, the tools that you must use in order to encourage and support that learning, the cultural issues. So the research will basically ask four questions. To what extent does company structure and culture help employees to use knowledge? What learning processes are taking place in industry? What tools are being used to enable knowledge transfer and learning? And to what extent does cognitive ability influence organizational learning? Now, some people may say, how could you say that depending on how smart you are, you influence learning? But for sure, the ability to retain information, the ability to actually use and synthesize and apply information must influence the learning of an organization, an individual, or a group. And those are the three ways in which an organization can learn. They can learn through their individuals, and that learning of individuals can either support or detract from the aims of the organization. Learning of groups, where you actually get into groups and partner and mentor one another and so on. And then there's learning of the organization itself, which, while not a human entity, the organization retains knowledge as you move on. So the organizational aspect of learning is also important. I handed out some single pages that give you on the backside the actual model that is being proposed. It was a little too detailed to put up on slides and expect you to see, so if you need to refer, please do. On the rapporteur's table at the back are extra copies if anyone did not get a copy. So it breaks down to, in terms of the cognitive ability, how cognition or cognitive ability impacts on organizational learning. We expect that the ability to memorize and recall, to comprehend, and to synthesize or analyze or apply the knowledge will impact on learning. The ability of the organization to have knowledge management structures in place, to actually use mentoring and storytelling in order to build that competence, will impact on learning. And why is that? Because there's a concept that knowledge exists in two forms, tacit knowledge and explicit knowledge. Explicit knowledge is the knowledge that I can speak to you about. But tacit knowledge is my skill that is inherent in me. It is soft. If I am a skilled mason, for example, and I want you to become a skilled mason, can I just write it down on a sheet and you read it, learn it off by rote, and you become a skilled mason? The answer is no. So I have to take my knowledge that is inherent in me, in my skill, convert it into some form of explicit knowledge, transfer it to you as explicit knowledge, and then you put it inside yourself as tacit knowledge and you become skilled. And it takes time, it's not a clean process. So mentoring and storytelling are some of the ways that we help that transfer between tacit and explicit knowledge and backward. Experiential learning. You know that a lot of what you can do now and what sets you apart from others as an expert did not come from school, it came from practice. So we have to figure out ways to support the giving of experience to the people in our organizations. And then the ability to, as they say, to reflect, to sit down quietly and think abstractly about what I did, what I should have done, how I should do it differently, to internalize learning, to observe and take from what I see some lesson that I can apply. Learning tools and practices that include experimentation, actual conceptualization of models or of approaches, and training and self-development. So that we're talking now about moving beyond what the traditional approach to learning is in many Trinidadian companies. Many Trinidadian companies feel, okay, I did an appraisal, I identified two gaps. If you are in a good company, I will send you on two training programs to address those gaps. And we call that continuous professional development, or we call that training and development, right? But that does not fill the gap. You need somebody to mentor you. You need somebody to argue with you and to help you to shape that competence. So training and self-development opportunities are one aspect, but all the rest I've spoken about are important as well. There are many learning processes. I had mentioned that you can learn in three groups. You can learn as an individual, you can learn in small groups, or you can learn as an organization. Bigger companies, what you find is that the multinationals in Trinidad, they have learning management systems in place. They might call it a knowledge management system, or they may have somebody called a chief information officer or a chief learning officer. So you find that the IBMs, the Witcos, the Lever Brothers, the Hewlett-Packards, those kind of companies, they have systems like this, even if they don't call it a learning management system or a learning organization system, in order to enable learning at these levels, and in order to support three types of learning. Single loop learning, which is where I go to do my day-to-day work, I make a mistake, I learn from that, and I never make that mistake again. That is the first lowest form of learning. That's the incremental type of learning. Then there's double loop learning, which is where I innovate. So I come up with a new idea. Now, the highest order of learning is called triple loop learning, which is where I do not wait till I am threatened with obsolescence. I say, let me continually improve my systems, right? And in order to continually improve, I have to learn to learn. That's the term that they use. I have to actually have a system in place to drive my learning before it is mandatory. And to support that, I have to unlearn past habits. I have to unlearn past systems. I have to remove the past procedures and processes from my org structure and replace it with new ones. And that's where triple loop learning and organizational unlearning partner. Organizational structure and culture are also necessary. And this means that we're looking at leadership, we're looking at philosophy, we're looking at values, we're looking at strategies. Because do we just want to learn for the sake of learning? The answer is no. We want to learn strategically. What are the areas that our company is focused on? What are the areas that we must continually innovate in? How can we support through the hiring of people, development of people, establishment of structures, changing approaches, partnerships? How can we support continual adaptation, not only of strategy and policy, but of methods? And how can we change the structure accordingly? Leadership is necessary. And all of this, as you can see, is tied up in a box, and we can call it culture. Incentives and rewards would be necessary. So the model looks a little bit complicated, but really it boils down to what I've said before, because it's four factors, those four little boxes: organization, structure, and culture, learning tools and practices, learning processes, and the cognitive ability of individuals that, at the end of the day, I believe influences organizational learning, and by extension, will influence the competitiveness of an organization and the long-term sustainability of that organization. Sorry. So in terms of testing now, because all I've done is a literature review and merged several models that now reflect some global model or some holistic model of learning. But I don't know how this translates into practice in Trinidad and Tobago. So the next step is to actually research it. What I propose to do is to go to the Trinidad and Tobago Manufacturers Association. They have the biggest group of registered manufacturers. It's about 209 manufacturers. And actually use a Likert questionnaire. That's a questionnaire where you have the range from 1 to 5 or 1 to 7. Very good, very poor, and a range in between. And you make several statements about all of the factors in the model. And you ask them, tell me how you practice it in your industry. When I collect that information back, I'll be collating that information and analyzing it by different questions, by factors, by different participants and company types, because I expect multiple responses from each individual company. I need to make sure that we use the statistics in order to give the quantitative side of the picture, because we don't just want to say, well, most people said this. We want to say, was it statistically significant? Did it mean something that we could actually use? Or was it an indication that more research had to be done? We have to actually make sure that the questions that we ask are valid questions. And so we will be testing whether the interpretation of what I'm asking is consistent across all of the people who responded, and whether it is repeatable. That's a measure of reliability. If I ask you the same question in two different questionnaires, would you answer me the same way? If not, then you would start to question my actual tool that I'm doing the research with. We'll be scoring, and based on the information I get, I'll be doing what is called a factor analysis to say how what correlation each factor has to organizational learning at the end of the day, in order to come up with a quantitative model, not just a qualitative one, as you've seen. The model will be refined based on data and validated by collecting some smaller group of data to test the numerical model that I finally propose. So far, I'm proposing only to test, to do this research in manufacturing. And so it's not generalizable to the whole of Trinidad yet, But what I would like to do is expand this to several sectors in Trinidad, so it becomes an organizational learning model for private industry in Trinidad and Tobago, or maybe for education and industry in Trinidad and Tobago, since it is learning that we're speaking about after all. And maybe there's value, and this is the recommendation, to conducting similar research based on the national priority sectors that we have, and based on what the needs of for different regions. So that St. Lucia, being similar to us in many ways in Trinidad, may find that this is the model that is closest to what they would need, because a UK model certainly would not fit a Caribbean context. So a model such as the one that we would like to get for Trinidad and Tobago could be applied throughout the Caribbean. Before I close, I just want to acknowledge the Faculty of Engineering and the School for Graduate Studies and Research of UWE. They funded me to be here, and I appreciate it. Thank you. We will not take comments yet until Ms. Dr. Joshi has presented. So I would appreciate your comments at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Marcia. And I think when we look at organizational learning, obviously there is a correlation with organizational growth. And I think that one of the aspects of Marcia's research, which is identifying learning tools and practices, may very well be answered by our next presentation, which is looking at ICTs as engines of growth. So I turn you over to Seema.
Thank you, Professor. Which presentation? See, they have changed the presentations, what they have done.
It should be there. It's there. You give it to him, right?
Yeah, I have done. I have.
That it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good afternoon, everybody. First of all, I would like to say thanks to Professor Alam Ahmed and Professor Gail Rigobert for giving me a chance to present a paper before such an august gathering here at St. Lucia. I'm really grateful to all of them. Coming now to my topic. The topic which I have chosen for today's presentation is, can IT and ITES be an engine of growth and empirical analysis? As all of you must be knowing that India emerged as one of the fastest growing economies in the world during the decade of 90s. And one of the major drivers of the growth of India's overall growth rate is service sector. And within the service sector, the growth is mainly driven by information technology and information technology enabled services. You might be knowing the fact that India has become 10th largest exporter of services in the world in the year 2007. Two-thirds of Fortune 500 companies, they have been outsourcing their requirement from India. And India is a top destination for offshoring in India today in the world. 20 Indian companies are among top 100 in the world. And 4 Indian companies, TCS, Wipro, Infosys, and Bharti Televenture, their yearly revenue have already crossed $1 billion. Not only this, so far as information technology industry is concerned, its contribution to our GDP, it has gone up to 5.5% of GDP in the year 2008, from 1.2% of GDP in the year 97-98. Not only this, so far as the contribution of this sector to employment is concerned, 2 million jobs have been created by this sector in the financial year 2008. And so far as contribution of this sector to export revenue generation is concerned, we are earning $64 billion from this sector alone. Keeping in view these facts and figures, the question which came to my mind was, can IT and ITS be an engine of growth or not? So keeping this question in mind,
I organized my presentation into 7 sections. I try to find out what the literature says regarding relationship between IT and economic development. Then I try to study the composition of IT market in India. Then I raised my question, gave my hypothesis, collected data, then methodology, that all these have been given. And finally, I reported my empirical results in the paper, and in the end, I gave my concluding remarks. Coming now to the review of literature, the literature says that there are clear-cut linkages between IT and economic development. IT impacts growth through different channels. There are several studies like Pohjola. There are several studies in Pohjola which say that returns on ICT investment are significant. There are several other studies which I have reported. You can see the third row. These studies show that since in India, IT sector has been successful, therefore the potential role which IT can play in India's economy, that should be studied. There are certain other studies like Shang and Miller which say that Indian case study should be used as a model for less developed countries, and Miller says even for developed countries of the world. Coming now to the composition of IT market in India, IT market in India is composed of IT domestic market and IT export market. And so far as Indian IT, ITS sector is concerned, it is divided into 3 parts, IT services and software, ITES BPO, and hardware. Globally, non-outsourcing services, these are termed as business process outsourcing. In India, these are termed as information technology-enabled services, meaning thereby services which are processed and delivered with the help of information technology, and this includes BPOs as well as KPOs. You must be knowing the fact that India's IT market is fastest growing in the Asia-Pacific region, and compound annual growth rate of India's IT market stands at 28% per annum during the past 5 years. As I have already mentioned, that the contribution of IT sector to GDP has increased from 1.2% of GDP in 97-98 to 5.5% of GDP in the financial year 2008. And so far as NASSCOM is concerned, NASSCOM is the Chamber of Commerce of IT in India, National Association of Software and Service Companies. This says, oil is for Saudi Arabia, and electronics and engineering goods are for Taiwan, IT and ITS will be for India. And it is being estimated that by 2015, 10-12% of our GDP will be contributed by IT sector alone. Presently, 46% of GDP of Saudi Arabia is contributed by oil sector. In case of Taiwan, 17% of GDP is contributed by electronics and engineering goods. And in our country, it is expected that it will be 7-8% this year, though the figures we have not got till date. So far as employment is concerned, these are the, I'm giving you the latest figure. 2 million jobs in the financial year 2008 have been generated by this sector. And you must be knowing that globally, IT and ITS market has been expanding. Therefore, the demand for outsourcing from India is further growing, despite the fact there are clear-cut rivals which we are, having in China, Philippines, and Ireland. Now, my question in the light of this development is, can IT and ITS be an engine of growth or not? In order to explore this question, I hypothesized that as IT and ITS will be growing in our country, then there will be generation of demand impulses in the country. Because as IT and ITS have been growing, there is direct demand for software professionals in the country. And these software professionals, they are indirectly employing, drivers, cooks, gardeners, car cleaners, carpet cleaners, and they are giving rise to secondary employment generation in the country. And for a developing country like India, it is the secondary employment generation which is very, very important for employment generation and poverty alleviation. And in addition to this, I also feel that as IT and ITS would grow, there will be greater consumption demand for food, clothing, apparel, healthcare, education services in other segments of the economy. And as this consumption demand will go up, this will give rise to production demand, and this production demand will further lead to generation of employment in the country. And it is this employment generation which will be placing disposable incomes in the hands of the people, which can help in improving the quality of life of our people. In order to test this hypothesis, I collected data, secondary data from NASSCOM publications, Government of India Economic Survey, World Development Indicators published by World Bank, and also from various issues of data cost. In addition to that, I did a primary survey in Gurgaon city of India. Gurgaon city is a city around Delhi, and it is a hub for various multinational corporations as well as domestic companies which are specializing in the area of BPOs, business process outsourcing, and back office operations. It is an electronic city. Government of Haryana, it has set up a software technology park in the area of 14,000 square feet in this area. In this area, when I listed the companies which are providing IT software services as well as BPOs and KPOs, I listed the companies, then I collected the survey and I analyzed the data. The analysis of data reveals that if one job is created for IT and ITS professional in this particular area, in this particular sample, this will lead to generation of employment, indirect employment for 0.48 workers in the country. And I use this 0.48 figure and combine that with secondary data. Secondary data says that 1.6 million were expected to be employed by this sector in the financial year 2008. This will lead to employment generation of indirect employment generation of 0.768 million in this area. So 0.768 million, this is 0.1%, this is 0.14% of our total employment generation. So far as direct employment generation is concerned, this will be equal to 0.34% of total employment. So far as the share of this particular sector in employment is concerned, this is quite small. This is minuscule at present, approximately 0.5% of total employment in our country. But from the primary data, I also calculated per capita, per income, per capita, per household, average monthly expenditure, from which I calculated annual expenditure, and that reveals that this 0.34% of directly employed people, they will be generating consumption demand, which will be accounting for 20% of value added. And 2.3 million people who are expected to be employed by this sector in the year 2010, they will be accounting for 29% of our value added in terms of consumption expenditure. So my hypothesis is valid. It is supported by the fact that though employment generation at present in this sector is low, but through consumption demand, this can contribute to the growth of the economy, as 20% of value added will be contributed by 1.6 million people, and 2.3 million people who are expected to be employed in the year 2010, they will be contributing approximately 29% of total value added. But if we want to sustain the growth which is driven by the service sector in India, especially IT and ITS, there are several challenges which the government of India will have to handle. For example, there is lack of social infrastructure at present, lack of physical infrastructure. ICD diffusion cannot take place without physical infrastructure. So this is another problem. Then power bottlenecks are very common. Then rupee appreciation and US subprime crisis, they also pose difficulties in the year 2008-09. But now we are out of it. Relatively we are out of it. Then there are challenges, several challenges which we have been facing in the field of IT and ITS, like rising labor cost. Then rapid growth in demand for skilled labor force. High attrition rate, then outsourcing backlash if we get it from US or European countries. Then there are socio-economic, health, ethical, and environmental issues which are related to the growth of ICT sector in India. In addition to that, business environment in our country is not as conducive as it is in China, and China is our one of rivals. And in one of my papers, I have highlighted my apprehension that who will be the future IT services or hub of the world? Will it be India or China? And that has been published in APTIR. Then there is need for good governance. We are, not only worried about, Satyam saga, you must have heard about Satyam fraud, which occurred in India. So it has opened up new issues in the area of corporate good governance. And whatever, policy measures are being introduced by the government to tackle the problems of social infrastructure, physical infrastructure, or, ICT infrastructure, all these measures will become zero unless and until we are having smart governance. So unless and until our government is simple, monitored, accountable, responsive, transparent, all the measures which have been announced in the 11th five-year plan, these will become, equal to zero unless and until stiff, the government remains committed as we find in case of China. And then there are problems related to service sector, like problem of measurement of output. Whatever data I have used in this particular paper, that data is not given by Central Statistical Organization for calculating national income of our country. We are having the main source of data is Central Statistical Organization, that is Ministry of Statistics. But so far as IT and ITS is concerned, so far as business services are concerned, we are making use of data given by NASSCOM. So availability of data after a time lag, then how to account for productivity changes which have been occurring over a period of time. Then technology has been changing very fast. How to capture the quality changes which are accounted for by these changes. These are very difficult to capture, and these are some of the problems which the government will have to resolve. There is an immediate need for policy intervention to meet these challenges if India wants to sustain the growth driven by service sector, and that too, especially by IT and ITS. But despite all this constraint, I like this quotation by one of our ministers. Now he is Minister of Road and Transportation, Mr. Kamal Nath. He says, the question for CEOs the world over is no longer, should my company go to India, but rather, can my company afford not to be in India? On the tourism front, it is incredible India, but on the economic front, it is clearly opportunity India. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Seema. That was very compact, comprehensive. And she left us with a significant question. Can my company afford not to be in India? So we had two presentations this morning, and both of them looked at organizational growth, development, and so on. Seema's own was more specifically pointed towards ICT as an engine or tool as in that organizational growth. And Marcia presented a model, a proposed model for organizational growth. So we'll take perhaps two questions at a time. We have maybe about 10 minutes to discuss those two presentations before we take the final one. Okay, I'll deal with these two right here for now. This gentleman and the one behind.
Thank you very much indeed for a good presentation. My question to the second presentation. Actually, I have comments about the IT. IT is no longer valid after 2000, because now it's ICT, Information and Communication Technology. So the term itself is invalid now, because now is the communication through the hardware and software. So after 2000, when the knowledge economy become reality, they change the IT to ICT. So if you want the companies to invest in India, please change it from IT to ICT. Okay? The second question is, which data you use to measure the ICT? You didn't show us the type of the data. You said that you have the data from WDI and other sources. There are many proxies used for ICT. So to show that this ICT is contributing to Indian economic growth, we want to know which type of data you use in your study, or the study reviewed that want to know the data that you use. Is the number of computers or telephone fixed lines or hardware and software or import of telecommunication equipment? So which type of data used to validate that ICT is contributing to Indian economic growth? Thank you very much.
Okay, and before Seema responds to that, let's just take one other question. Is yours on Seema's presentation as well? Just pass the microphone back, please.
Thank you for your intelligent and unique presentation. My question is that this IT or ICT, that's not the difference what I'm trying to look for. My question, how far it is bringing a revolutionary change among the micro entrepreneurs in the country, the contribution of this sector of IT or ICT for the micro entrepreneurs in India? Thank you.
Okay.
See, my response to your first question is that whether, you know, it is ICT, the word I'm using, or IT, it is immaterial. Because it is implicit that information technology cannot operate without communication. That is why, you know, how can the software or the hardware can operate without communication? This is quite obvious. So whether I'm using this term information technology, because I have to go by the standards, by the concepts which are used by NASSCOM. And as you know, clarified in the beginning, that I have been making use of NASSCOM's data. And you'll be, you might be knowing the fact. In case of India, even Central Statistical Organization is making use of the data on IT and ITS, which is supplied by NASSCOM, right? And I also clarified, you know, when I was giving the sources of data, that I have taken secondary sources of data, clubbed that with primary data, right? And since there is paucity of time, therefore I have reported the final results. If you are interested in more tables, my working paper is available on the website of Institute of Economic Growth on, you know, IT and ITES. There you will be finding all the detailed tables. So here the you know, constraint was that you have to present your paper in 10 pages only. Therefore, I have to cut short my paper. So I have given the results. And realizing the importance of IT, you know, when in 1991 we opened up for globalization, you must be knowing that a new economic policy was launched in India in 1991. Immediately after 1991, telecom policy was announced by the government of India in 91, followed by, you know, new telecom policy in 93, broadband policy in 2004. Why? Because it was being realized by the government that if we are, you know, we want to tap the potential of BPOs or KPOs, we will not be able to do without communication, right? Therefore, these are interdependent, and whether I'm using the term ICT, it is obvious that I'm talking about information technology, but I'm using the classification given by NASSCOM. And in India, IT industry is divided into three segments: IT software and services, ITES BPO, and hardware. My concern was the two segments. When I took the primary data, I have taken BPOs and some of the KPOs also, so that my, you know, sample should be broad-based. Software companies too have been taken. Hopefully you're satisfied with what I'm saying. And my answer to second question, that how, you know, ICT is impacting micro entrepreneurs. In India, you know, the government has launched various e-governance campaigns now. And directly these are not impacting the micro entrepreneurs, but in the 11th five-year plan, if you go through, that there is a, you know, special provision for you know, making use of this ICT. There is a Tara Hub which has been started in one state, and there is Shokaryam.com which is which has been launched in Andhra Pradesh government. So all these facilities can be utilized even by the micro entrepreneurs. And so far as, you know, self-help groups are concerned, these are coming up very fast in the southern states of India. So they will be making use of all this, because now we are having a ministry has been started for looking after the interests of small and medium enterprises, micro enterprises. So all these things are there in our mind, and in the 11th five-year plan, there is a provision for all that. So you will have to wait till 2012, because if this government stays in power, let's see. That is why I'm talking about commitment. Policies are there. In the 11th five-year plan, there is a special chapter which has been dedicated to micro enterprises. So let's see what happens, how it comes out after, you know, 5 years. So we have to wait and watch till 2012.
Okay, I'm going to take two more questions. This gentleman and then this lady at the back.
For a very insightful and comprehensive presentation, and especially the implications for employment generation. Now, my question is, do you have any breakup as far as the indirect employment generation concern between skilled and unskilled employment?
Okay. Can you take the other one?
Okay.
And the other question, just pass the mic across, please. Is your mic on?
You're hearing me?
Yes.
In terms of the methodology for your data collection, are you doing some cross-sectional analysis of manufacturing companies? Or so are you looking at probably different industry sectors, or probably SMEs versus large companies, or probably foreign-owned companies versus local companies, or is it just manufacturing companies?
Okay, so,
that's one. Uh-huh. And for Dr. I'll just say Seema. That's probably easier for me. Interestingly, we are at a conference on sustainable development, and I think the focus should be on, well, the triple bottom line of sustainable development, which is combining the economics, the social aspects, and the environmental aspects. So you spoke a lot about growth and increased consumption, and of course, with increased consumption, the spin-off from your ITS or your ICT sector. So with increased consumption, of course, you're going to have increased production. Increased production means increased consumption of raw materials, increased waste. So is there some way to do some analysis, some environmental analysis of the impact of the growth of the ICT sector simultaneously with the economic analysis?
So first of all, I'll be answering Professor Pranav's question, whether I'm having any breakup of skilled versus unskilled labor force. In the table, I have shown that if one job is generated for skilled professional, IT professional, maybe engineer is there, then he will spin off jobs for 0.48 indirect work, indirect employment for 0.48 workers who may be semi-skilled, low-skilled, or no-skilled, like domestic servant. I have clubbed this under the head no-skilled, semi-skilled or unskilled worker, which comprises of domestic servants, because the question which were being asked were how many, whether they are hiring any domestic servant or not, whether they are hiring cooks or not, whether they are having drivers or the security guards or carpet cleaners or car cleaners they were hiring or not. So this have been in the questionnaire, these questions were raised and data was clubbed. Therefore, when I reported the data, I have tried to find out the relationship that if one direct job be created, how many workers they will be creating the job. Mm-hmm. Skilled labor. Data I'm having, sir, and I haven't looked into that aspect. I was just interested in validating my thesis, but still data is there, and further I want to fit a model to find out from the whatever data has been collected that how this can be I want to further strengthen my analysis by fitting some model so that clear cut answers we can get. Data is there with me, right? And coming now to question that in this particular paper, I am very much aware of the implications, negative implications of the growth of ICTization of any economy. And in one of my papers, I have raised this question: is services hub of the world is becoming an e-junkyard? Because what is happening in India is that consumption of mobile phones, consumption of, and not only in India, in almost all the developing as well as developed countries, not only the consumption of mobile phones have increased, computers, laptops have been increasing, but these are becoming obsolete at an equally fast rate. Now the question is how to dispose of this e-waste. I haven't tackled this question in this particular paper, but I am having a separate paper which is coming up in an edited volume, and that looks into the implications of e-waste. Because in India, the problem which we were facing till 2010 was that not only this e-waste has been increasing, but our country is used as an, along with China, it is used as an e-junkyard by developed countries of the world, because there are no laws for preventing this disposal. This has become ground for disposing of e-waste of developed countries of the world. But very, very happy, in the month of May 2010, Government of India has come out with a notification that how this e-waste will be tackled. And in this particular notification, responsibility of each stakeholder, whether it is consumer or the industry, this has been fixed up. So this has been done only recently. Earlier, this was not there. And one more thing which I want to highlight is that in India, why I took up this topic, the reason being that presently, agriculture, you know, when we talk about the growth of a country, there are three segments. Either we have to rely on agriculture or industry or services. So far as agriculture in India is concerned, it has stagnated. Elasticity of employment in agriculture has reached zero. So far as industry is concerned, it is not generating much jobs. In the agriculture growth rate in 2009, it was negative. In 2009, growth of industry, it slumped. So the only hope was service sector. When I am talking about growth driven by service sector, it does not mean that I am undermining the importance of agriculture and industry. Because I am also very much aware that the growth of any economy driven by service sector is not sustainable unless and until it is complemented by agriculture and industrial growth. And in fact, this I highlighted in one of my papers, which was published in September 2004, edition of Economic and Political Weekly, that whether, you know, isolated growth of service sector is desirable or not. So this paper is available on the net. You can go through that.
I remember.
She's going to respond to you now.
Susanna, what the research would be done, the research would be done through the Trinidad and Tobago Manufacturers Association. The plan is to use the entire database in order to tackle all the manufacturers registered with them. I think it's about 209 of them. And it is going to allow me to do a cross-sectional study, because the aim is to compare the results across subsectors. Some of the areas we would be looking at would be light manufacturing, heavy manufacturing, energy, and I think there were some agriculture-related areas as well in terms of the companies registered. So we would be doing comparisons across the different subsectors, and I would also, depending on the availability of the data, compare those subsector results to subsector results in other countries. Right, very, very good for me. The other thing that we've noticed is that the larger companies, they have the more mature systems. So the SMEs would be eager to learn from them in order to improve their systems. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have two more questions for this segment before we take Nolana. So was your hand up, sir? This gentleman and then Betty. Okay. Can somebody just pass him?
I'm by Chalmers, University of Technology. I have a question for Marsha.
Could you check your mic, please?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Okay.
Okay. So my question is, when you're doing this factor analysis, since it seems to be a pretty complicated model, it seems to be a pretty complicated model that you're suggesting, looking at the handouts.
Are you asking how I'm going to do the factor analysis?
Yes, I'm wondering how are you going to be able to separate causality.
Each of those, because it will become quite a long questionnaire one. And then doing the factor analysis for all of those would be something like 23 different factors, sub-factors, so it will become a very long study. The approach is going to be, I already found a very widely used learning organization questionnaire that was used in what they have coined in the literature, westernized studies. That learning organization questionnaire has been validated in smaller countries. I had mentioned Taiwan and Malaysia as examples. There are maybe 5 or 6 countries that where this learning organization questionnaire has been implemented, and where factor analysis and so on has been used in order to validate it for the context, so that there have been tweaks made to it to suit the context. Basically, I'm aiming to do very much the same sort of thing, but because my model is different from theirs in that I've added sections, because I've taken the theories from several areas and merged them in order to make what I think is a more holistic model, I'm going to have to add some questions into that questionnaire. And the factor analysis would be done by using SPSS for one, and then by using Lizrel and other software in order to actually check the correlation factors, like the R factor, to check the variances and so on, and see what the links are for each one. Now, what I may have to do is, I expect that some of them would basically count themselves out very soon. So the further testing of that model may come down to, let's say, 10 or 12 factors or subfactors instead of the 23 I'm proposing. But I'm starting with as holistic a view as I can, and I'll let them count themselves out instead of me deciding what should be out.
Okay.
If I just may ask one follow-up question. Who is it that is going to do this, fill out these questionnaires in the companies?
Who is going to?
Yeah, who's going to do? Is it going to be the CEO of every company?
Or who are the respondents that I'm targeting?
Yeah.
What I would like to get, I've looked at several different research approaches that have been used, and some people use both a management representative as well as people such as supervisors in the lower levels of the hierarchy. And I think that that is more effective because a CEO may have a perception, but a supervisor may really understand reality of learning and how it impacts or how it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So I want to get a true picture, and therefore I'll be asking for multiple respondents in companies. And where I do, I will then collate that information in order to get a truer picture of what measure is in each of the companies.
Okay, and final question from Betty.
Marcia, with reference to your model, could you tell me exactly where you would capture post-learning assessment and evaluation?
Let me just look at the model. To me, I would think that the learning assessment, the evaluations would fit inside learning tools and practices. Now, we were talking more of transfer of knowledge rather than testing, because we're speaking more of, it's more of a practical and experiential type of learning inside of organizations, inside of industry. But were we to do measurement, then we would have to maybe fit it inside the training and self-development opportunities as sub factors. But I'm not going as deep as breaking down training and development into development of curriculum, the delivery of training, the assessment of competencies, and so on. And all of that would come under training and development system, I believe.
But you agree that as far as organizational learning, assessment and evaluation is important, that would have to be considered if you're looking at organizational learning?
Yes, and what I'll do is actually put it down, and since this is a theoretical model, it can be adapted before I test. So thanks for the feedback.
One other thing though, are you aware there is an international standard that deals with the management of training programs?
I've heard of it.
Okay, well, a recommendation that you could probably check your model against that international standard.
Thank you very much.
Nope. Okay, and I'm sure that you will hook up at lunchtime, Betty, and elucidate her a little more on the standards. We're going to move on now to Nolana's presentation, which I indicated earlier was from yesterday's session 3 on gendered applications of the carbon footprint. So we will have time to get her presentation and a couple of questions in before we have to wrap up. Nolana?
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Nolana Lynch, as our Chair said earlier, and it's my pleasure to present to you on the gendered applications of the carbon footprint. Now, my presentation is based on research that was conducted in terms of developing carbon management programs for Trinidad and Tobago and the Caribbean region, and it was implemented in oil and gas companies, project management consultancy firms, but this particular presentation is on the findings that were obtained from the study conducted at the University of the West Indies, which compared the carbon footprints of both students and staff in the natural sciences department. Now, what is the carbon footprint? Have any of y'all heard about carbon footprinting before? Yes, and have y'all implemented any of these strategies in your lives? No? Well, it is my intent today that after this presentation to encourage you to have these behaviors implemented into your life and to have some sort of lifestyle change, because it's not just about research, but it has to have far-reaching impacts on both the persons that the study was conducted on as well as audiences like yourself. So basically, the carbon footprint measures our impact on the environment, and it analyzes greenhouse gas emissions due to basic factors or sectors in our lives, for example, transportation, our food, our waste management, as well as our electricity usage. Now, this is just a little model which shows that all the different factors sum up to the effects that we're seeing today in terms of climate change and global warming. Knowing our carbon footprint, it allows us to analyze the different sectors in our lifestyles, in our organization's operations, and to reduce our carbon emissions in the various sectors. This decreases overall the amount of carbon being emitted into the atmosphere, and decreasing our carbon footprint is a direct measure that showcases how close we are to achieving sustainability objectives worldwide. For this study, the secondary data was first conducted with research done on the carbon footprint, how it is implemented in various organizations, and then a questionnaire was constructed especially for the target group, which in this case was staff and students at the University of the West Indies. The questionnaire was constructed such that four different sectors were analyzed, which you can see from the slide. Then a gender analysis was conducted on the male and females of the sample, which included the collated data of the students and staff findings. And this actually showcased, this showcased the different areas in which males and females respond to sustainable behavior in terms of being able to develop strategies which can more or less focus on how we can highlight to males and females in different sectors of society and encourage them to reduce their carbon footprint. The standard calculation bodies that were used for this study was the Greenhouse Gas Protocol along with the Environmental Management System, which is an ISO standard. The Greenhouse Gas Protocol has developed a range of calculation devices which allows us to transfer the information that I receive from the questionnaires into metric tons of carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalent. From the calculations that were done, a number of key findings were found. And we're going to focus first on the direct emissions and the findings from those areas, which were transportation and electricity, and then we'll focus on the indirect emissions, wherein a qualitative analysis was conducted on those findings. Now, if we look at the bar chart to your right, to my right, the green bars represent the males in the sample, and the blue bars represent the females in the samples. On your horizontal axis, you will see the ranges of carbon dioxide emitted, and on your vertical axis, you will see the percentage of respondents. Now, from this bar chart, we can see that females, a smaller percent, they emitted within the less than 0.1 metric tons of carbon dioxide. Now, this was due to the fact that they would have very little local transportation, none at all in terms of broad road commutes and flight emissions. And the larger ranges, especially mid-ranges, were accounted for road transportation, which would be local commute to and from the University of the West Indies campus. And the largest range would be persons who, along with local commute, also had a number of flights throughout the year. So we can see that the males, they emitted within the two mid-regions, as opposed to the females, which possessed emissions throughout the entire ranges, but with the highest percentage being in the second range of 0.1 to 1.0 to 10 metric tons of carbon dioxide. This bar chart shows the emissions that were due to electricity usage. And as we can see, males emitted within the smallest to the largest range, which was accounted for a number of reasons, including the electricity usage due to air condition, due to how often or the length of their use of television sets, radios, and all other electricity devices in their homes. As opposed to the women, which possess within the four smallest ranges, which would be 0.1 to 8.0 metric tons of carbon dioxide, which shows that they had more sustainable electricity usage or because of their lifestyle, they weren't able to use electronic devices for as long a period throughout the day. The third bar chart, it shows the metric tons due to the total direct emissions, which would be your local transport, your flight emissions, along with the electricity emissions. And from this, we can see that the highest percentage of females, they produce emissions within the lowest range, and the highest percentage of males produce within the second range. Now, the next slide I want you to pay close attention to, because it shows that if we reduce, we remove flight emissions completely from this study, then we would have persons which have the highest percentage the highest percentage of respondents within the lowest range. And then we have the two highest percentage of all the males producing within the two smallest ranges. So if we remove flight emissions, the flights are the largest contributor to our carbon footprint. And there's a lot of debate about whether or not we should travel, whether we should offset our carbon dioxide, because we can't agree that all of us, or most of us, had to take an airplane to get here. So there's a lot of debate on how we can combat our emissions due to flights. And now move on to the qualitative analysis, which highlighted emissions due to food and waste. The first pie charts, they show the percentage of males and females which bought local food as opposed to foreign-produced goods. Here we see that it's relatively similar, as in we have around 61-65% of females and males, they purchase foreign foods as opposed to local goods. And local goods, or purchasing local goods, is better for our carbon footprint because there are less emissions due to transportation to obtain these goods. However, here we see that a larger proportion of persons produce foreign goods, and it was debated that this could be a representative of the percentage of local versus foreign goods that we have in our Caribbean markets. But it also shows that the respondents prefer to purchase foreign goods for a number of reasons, which would be preference or marketing and so forth. However, I do encourage that persons purchase local foods or local goods as opposed to foreign goods. And then we looked at the production of vegetable gardens to reduce your carbon footprint and to reduce the amount of food that you have to purchase on the market, along with purchasing of organic food versus other types of food. We see that males, 50% of them, they were able to produce vegetable gardens, which offset the cost of their food per month as compared to females. Now, in this sample, a large amount of the females, they lived close or around the campus, which meant that they had a smaller land area to produce vegetable gardens. However, quite a few of them were able to produce vegetable gardens on their balconies or within any little space that they had, which would be a sustainable agriculture, and were able to produce vegetable gardens nonetheless. For organic food, we see a larger percentage of females were able to purchase organic food. And this may be so because they were able to offset the cost, or they were prepared to pay more money for organic food because it had a lesser impact on the environment. For waste management, the average amount of waste is showed in the first row. And then we see the percentage of persons that were able to take the organic waste that they use or recycle the inorganic waste, which is very much a sustainable waste management practice. Here we see the larger proportion of females, they took the organic waste that they had, or that was produced from them purchasing food, and they were able to use it in their vegetable gardens to fertilize it, as opposed to buying an inorganic fertilizer. And in the third row, we see the percentage of respondents that were recycling goods. And it's sort of similar to the proportion of waste that was emitted by both male and females, because we have a larger proportion of males that are recycling the amount of waste that were generated, as opposed to for females, where we see a larger proportion, a proportion of females similar to the amount of waste that is being emitted. For the findings, as I was explaining shortly before, a lot of the females had lower direct emissions because they live closer to campus. The men, however, they had a lot of familial transportation responsibilities, and as such, even though they may have been commuting in a shorter distance because of all the different stops they had, their average worked out higher to the female average. In addition, the males tend to have a higher amount of emissions due to electricity because of the different recreational activities, playing video games, watching television, having AC on for longer hours, and this meant that they had less energy-saving techniques. For the flight emissions, when we removed it completely from the data set, it reduced the amount of emissions from the female subset to 92.31% of females into the smallest range. And the men were now into the two smaller ranges, which meant that the flight emissions accounted for the majority of emissions of the subgroup. In terms of indirect emissions, males and females, they bought similar proportions of local food. The females bought more organic food, and they showed that more or less the males and females were relatively on par in terms of their sustainable food practices. However, when it came to organic waste, the women, they had utilized their organic waste. They were able to show that whole nutrient cycle and reuse their organic waste to fertilize their vegetable gardens. And males, they were able to recycle their goods more than the females. The main goal when we are analyzing the carbon footprint is to reduce our carbon emissions to the lowest possible value, tending towards zero. And you may say, well, this is very difficult because we all need resources. We all need resources to live. However, we have to be able to lower our impact on the environment. And the most reasonable way so far has been developed to reduce our carbon footprint towards zero is to purchase or to invest in carbon offsets. A carbon offset program is an investment mechanism which allows us to invest into carbon sinks, which can be developed through mass reforestation projects, renewable energy projects, and carbon sequestration projects. And this allows us as human beings, after we have implemented all these sustainable practices, to invest into carbon offsets to reduce our carbon footprint towards zero. And this will mean that we will now be living a carbon neutral lifestyle and hence have a minimum impact on our environment. Recommendations from this project is to ensure that carbon management awareness programs are implemented throughout the region, throughout Trinidad and Tobago, which encourages persons of various sectors of varying levels to reduce their carbon footprint. And at present, the questionnaire is being transformed to cater to primary schools and secondary school students, along with a number of different sectors within our societies. Also, there have been campaigns on climate change, carbon management, geared towards children and young people to ensure that sustainable habits are instilled in them at a very young age. Because we can cater to our middle-aged categories, we can cater to persons in different working sectors, but then we still have to nurture our young people so that they themselves can also implement these behaviors into their lifestyles. So in conclusion, as said before, females contributed to less direct emissions, but for indirect emissions, males appear to utilize more sustainable practices. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Nolana. And I don't think this is going to degenerate into a heated gender debate, but we all know who spends the most time playing with electronic toys, right? So we take two questions. We still have quite a bit of time. We'll do them in pairs just for the ease of the participant. Somebody had a hand up at the back? No? It was just you? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for providing very interesting perspective here, having implications for climate change controversies. Now, I have some apprehensions regarding the methodologies generally used, where they overestimate carbon emissions. For example, you know, in many cases in agriculture, in organic refuse and many things, when methane is emitted, it is actually the carbon CO2 absorbed from the nature and it is given out. So there is no additionality here. You know, you are not generating additional CO2. And many of the standard calculation doesn't take care, and they overestimate CO2 emissions from the developing countries. So I want to know whether this has been taken care as far as the methodologies that you have used. Thank you.
And was there a second question? No? Okay, go ahead.
In terms of the methodology used for this particular study, the focus was transportation and electricity, and those were the two areas that we did direct emission calculations on. And it is not directly related to agricultural emissions, but I do understand your point in terms of the methane cycle and the carbon dioxide being generated through our agriculture and being recycled. However, for this particular study, it's not relevant because it's only focused on transportation emissions, which would be vehicular emissions, along with aircraft emissions, and then electricity, which would be how electricity is generated in terms of your power plants, and then how it is utilized.
This lady at the back, and then this gentleman, we'll take those two.
On the methodology, did you actually calculate your carbon footprint? Because there are a lot of carbon footprint calculators online that you can just go and plug whatever information in and whatever data in and get some information. So can you just tell me a little bit about the methodology?
In terms of calculating the carbon footprint online, there are numbers, there are numerous carbon footprint calculators, and not all of them are accurate. In terms of, this was a physics study, so I had to ensure that the calculations themselves were standard calculations, and many of them are based, they are general based in terms of if it is that you put in specific data, you wouldn't exactly receive a specific outcome, but more or less a general answer in terms of what was being input into the calculator. So for this particular study, I used the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, which is a standard calculation buddy. It has a series of spreadsheets which you actually see the different factors which promote, for example, transportation. You have different vehicular factors, emission factors, fuel usage factors, and so forth. And all these are taken into consideration for the calculation of each sector. Similar for the electricity, there was the electricity emission factor, carbon dioxide emissions due to the type or the way in which the electricity was generated. And these will take it into consideration and place into the spreadsheets, and then it will produce the amount of metric tons of carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Can I just nitpick a little bit? Mm-hmm. Because you did mention accuracy. Mm-hmm. One of my pet peeves is a lot of figures of after your decimal point. So you have like your percentages at like 50.00 mm-hmm. or 39.38%. And you can't really measure that level of accuracy. So it's quite okay to round it off mm-hmm. to probably without the decimal points, okay?
Okay, that's thank
just,
you.
That's just being an engineer, sorry.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for the advice. Yes? So? Yeah, he's talking about the qualitative aspect. Was the decision, for example, to grow a vegetable garden a result of economic need as opposed to awareness that they were actually reducing their carbon footprint?
I was looking for something about the motivation. That they had to do this. Was it purely just an economic reason to have a vegetable garden, or were they aware that this would reduce the carbon footprint and that became somewhat of a motivation?
Yes, okay, just hold on, because you wanted to add something to that question?
Just maybe something. I had a student 3 years ago. She did something similar, but she looked into our own students, how they are aware about carbon CO2s and environmental issues. What interestingly we found, year one are more aware than year two is more aware than year three. So what we found, the more they're studying in the university, the more they become less aware about CO2. Yeah, I know. And that girl got distinction. in her result. It was a very well-executed research.
So maybe it implies the need for a further breakdown of your male-female population. Yes, go ahead. We'll take the third question. It's to the same person. All right, so go ahead and then she'll respond.
Hi, I was just wondering if you knew where the seeds these students were planting were coming from for their organic or inorganic gardens. Were they local produce seeds or were they flown in and bought in supermarkets?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nolana, go ahead.
To answer the first question about the motivation and awareness, or what were the factors that encouraged their vegetable garden production and so forth, no, that wasn't taken into consideration in this aspect of the study. However, it will be taken into consideration in the study that is going to be done on youth and children, because it is better to have a qualitative approach to it, to see what their awareness is, what is their motivation, and to encourage them to develop programs. For us to develop programs to help them, we need to know what motivates them, what they're aware of, and all the different factors. And for the second question on where the seeds came from, no, but they were vegetable gardens, more or less they were season gardens, and they were developed from different seasoning that were bought or from seeds that they would have obtained from their neighbors and so forth. So it was more local-based vegetables that were grown in their gardens.
And as Professor Ahmed indicated a while ago, did you make any provision for the distinction among the year groups in terms of levels of awareness?
For the first part of the study, it was staff versus students, and that one compared as your lifestyle changes, how your carbon footprint changes. And that is a very interesting study as well, because it showcases our students' lifestyle, what it is, what are their priorities in terms of their lifestyle. And then as you evolve into a working adult, how does this carbon footprint change? And that was a very interesting study. However, for the gender analysis, it mostly focused on the genders and highlighting the differences in their lifestyle, in their behaviors.
Okay, thank you. I'm a little lost with regard to the timing of the session, but I think we're supposed to be wrapping up now. Is that it? Okay. I'd like to thank the audience for your active participation in making this a very interesting and learning experience. And in particular, I'd like to thank our three presenters this morning for their presentations on both learning, organizational learning, growth and development, ICT and its contribution to growth, and finally, gender and carbon footprints. We have a burning issue? A suggestion, okay.
It's used in a very decontextualized framework in this study, and you cannot examine gender outside of race and class. So as this study is beginning to further develop, that triangulation of race, class, ethnicity, all of that is going to color what gender looks like and the activities in which people are engaged in. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, all right, so we are wrapping up, and thank you all for your attention this morning.
Participants, thank you.